This is the Medicast, February 7th, 2011.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of the Medicast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to check out everybody and have you come in and check out the show this week. If you're watching the show on the TV, maybe you're using a set-top box like the Roku or Boxy or something like that to watch the Medicast video version on your TV set, or perhaps you're checking it out on your computer at medicast.tv or listening to the audio version of the program. There'll always be an audio version available for you. You can do all that over at the Medicast website, medicast.com/blog, or you can go to the video versions at medicast.tv. In any case, it's great to have you here joining me this week on the show. You can always reach me at the email address podmedic@mac.com, and we'll have more contact information coming up later in the show, but I want to try to get into the meat of the program a little more quickly these coming weeks to try to just kind of refine the opening of the show, and I hope you will enjoy that. Let me know what you think and get back in touch with me. We're going to get into the listener email right now and check out what you had to say in response to things recently here on the show. Let's jump into this week's listener email. And I wanted to jump in here and start off with an email I got from listener Steve. Steve's been listening to the show for a long time. He's now got a job with a 911 agency and is working with his field training officer as a paramedic and is really enjoying that process. And he shot me an email with a question about a patient he had. And questions about when do you jump forward in RSI, that extremely that extreme respiratory distress patient, and you know, at what point in the crash process do you do that? And I'm going to approach this from a couple of caveats here. First off, while I do not RSI, we have RSI available to us in our jurisdiction. If I'm en route to the hospital, I can get on the radio and have a supervisor meet me en route to any hospital I'm heading to nearby pretty quickly to jump on an RSI patient's for me, and I would just assist them with that process. So that said, we have the ability to do that here in our jurisdiction, while I do not necessarily personally do that. I also come at this from the direction of my nursing background. So I'm a paramedic, I'm also a nurse, and I've become much more immune to reacting to vital signs quickly. And I don't want to say that I ignore them, but I tell you, I've been in hospital settings where, you know, a low BP by itself does not necessarily cause an extreme alarm in the treating physicians and the staff. We monitor, we are very observant, we keep track of it, but you know, if we can stabilize a low BP and keep it from going any lower, that's in many cases considered just as good until we can figure out what else is going on that is causing the BP to be low. So it's more of a diagnostic process and a wait and see process, unless there's just imminent crash going on. So those are my caveats. Steve's talking about a respiratory patient that he had from a nursing home, recent CVA patient, showed up, patient had was tachycardic, BP 80 over 50, or 80s and 50s, rate ventilatory rate, respiratory rate of around 55. Looks like he were thinking sepsis of some sort. They were seeing extreme respiratory distress. Just a lot going on. Carbon dioxide level, ETCO2, was low at 5, and they were really trying to figure out the treatment process. Of course, they had the patient on a cannula and got the level up to 95, started to drop again. They put the patient on a non-rebreather. The patient, pulse ox, came up to around 99%, but they were having difficulty getting IVs on the patient and were wondering next steps. Now, they were pretty close to a hospital and decided to just manage the patient as they were and get them into the ER without going any further, which would have been IO and RSI. And you just wanted to know my thoughts on this. So kind of giving you an overshoot of what this patient looked like based on what Steven's telling me. And I'll give you my thoughts on this. Extended transport time, I would definitely have my IO gun out and ready to go. I'd have all my prep materials. And I'd be really thinking about whether or not I needed to RSI this patient. That said, I will go the next step though. We have an elderly patient, CVA patient, a recent CVA, showing signs of sepsis. Do we want to put another route for infection into this patient? And by that, I mean the ventilation. Putting an ET tube in this patient is going to guarantee they're going to get on a ventilator in the ICU for 24 hours minimum at the hospital. And the outcomes for hospital-acquired pneumonias and other infections for this patient are not good at all. Okay? So my thought process is, let's do what we can to keep these types of patients as stable as possible. If the blood pressure is in 80s over 50s and it's staying there, if you can, think about getting fluids. This is an opportunity to use your radio and call in and ask the hospital, give them your ETA, tell them what's going on, and ask them, hey, we cannot get an IV. We want to know, would you like us to establish an IO and go ahead and give them a fluid bolus, which might bring that pressure up and support it a little bit, along with the oxygenation and everything else? Or do you want us to just hold off as we are and get them into the hospital? So there's some things that you can do here. Use your communication aids. Get the question answered by the doc if you're curious and think about what you want to do. Your reasonable transport time, and you've got them stable and they're not really changing. I mean, she didn't deteriorate during this call. She stayed where she was. So there wasn't necessarily a need to aggressively manage this particular patient other than careful monitoring and oxygen as needed, and be prepared to go the next step if you need to. But RSI, intubation, and IO administration are really, you need to be careful in the administration. It sounds like, Steve, you and your field training officer, have that type of careful approach to administering these invasive techniques. And, you might think about, instead of going that route, think about getting something like one of those vein light or some other similar device to help you find a better source for venous access. It might be an option for you. You might want to talk to a hospital infusion nurse about possible sites to better get access for these types of patients. And the next step is talk to your medical director, your training officer, or your ER physician upon arrival and say, hey, doc, this is what we got. We just brought her in, and this is what we're thinking about. We want to know. We were thinking that should we be going to the next step and thinking about IO and intubation for this particular patient? What are your thoughts? Okay. Physicians that I know always appreciate people asking intelligent questions and in trying to improve their patient care for the next patient that comes in. So deal with it that way. And I think you guys did the right thing. But again, you have to make every call is going to stand on its own. And I would have been prepared to intubate that patient. I would have been prepared to go with an IO on that patient. Clearly, we probably needed fluid support, and so it might have been something that we would have considered. Patient was unresponsive, so certainly an IO gun would have been an option for this particular patient if you couldn't get other vascular access. I hope that answers your question, Stephen, and good one. I know I'm kind of beating around the bush and hemming and hawing, but it's hard to say without being there with the patient, and I don't want to second-guess anything you or your field training officer did, and ultimately, a patient who is stable with a low set of vital signs is stable. And while they're not getting better, they're not getting any worse. So you want to be prepared for major interventions. But it may be that, you know, she was able to maintain where she was for the short transport. Now, if it was a longer transport time, we could do more. So I look forward to hearing from you, and thanks for your email. And I look forward to hearing from the rest of you. What are your thoughts on this? How do you deal with this? How do you deal with asking questions of your medical director or asking questions of the ER doctors when you get there to find out what their thoughts were about the treatment process and direction for this particular patient? Because I got news for you. Depending on which ER doc was on, they might go in a different direction. So they're not medical treatment is more of an art than we like to admit sometimes. And sometimes you just got to kind of go with your gut, follow your protocols, of course. But sometimes when the gut reaction on when to go to that next step is the most important thing. And you develop that with time and experience. But when you get to the point where you can start to trust that reaction, you can try to make some of these decisions. So thanks, Stephen. Next up, got a check-in from Michelle over on Facebook. And she wanted to ask me a question about dealing with bedside manner and our patients. So if we have, let's say you've been talked to because you're too stern or you're not caring enough for your patients how you treat and deal with your patients in your personality and your manner. How do you deal with that? How do you deal with getting too attached to patients and getting too close to patients? Trying to distance yourself to manage the potential for stress that you might have in an emergency care setting. So, Michelle, I'm just going to kind of give you my 2 cents worth. I've already responded back to her on a Facebook message, but just to kind of convey my thoughts to you. Certainly, it's important to maintain some professional distance with patient care. That said, there is a whole lot you can do with a caring attitude and a caring approach to dealing with your patients. Holding a person's hand, smiling, talking to them in a gentle voice, really conveying to them that you care what happens to them is, I think, just as important as giving them the right medicine at the right time or intubating or RSIing at the right time, as we talked about in the previous segment. I think that there is a lot that you can do to help every patient by having a caring approach to them. Now, I'm not going to say that it's fake if you put an act on for it. I don't think it's fake because you really do care, but you can put a smile on your face and internally keep that composure, internally keep some mental and emotional distance, but you can still smile at them. You can still ask them and care for them and hold their hand when they need it. I know that it can make you feel a little bit uncomfortable sometimes, and yeah, it could mean that you're getting a little close. I don't mean too close. I just mean you're getting a little closer dealing with that patient and caring for that patient personally. That's not necessarily a bad thing. I know that it can lead to devastation when you have a patient crash or that a situation comes up where you have a bad outcome and you have a patient who died that really touched you in some way. That's going to happen to each and every one of us. It's not a question of if it's going to happen to you. It's a question of when. And dealing with stress and things associated with those types of reactions in the workplace and what we do is something you can prepare for. It doesn't mean that it's not going to happen. It just means that the effects won't last as long because you have a plan in place to appropriately deal with stress as it approaches you. But you do need to care about your patients. I'm going to tell you the difference between a great provider and a mechanical, book smart, and protocol appropriate provider is that person who can get in the back of an ambulance and calm a patient down by just talking to them quietly and smiling at them. Okay? And again, we've talked about this before. A smile on your face and a good demeanor and a good manner of just making conversation with your patients to help them relax can do a lot. It can lower heart rates. It can lower blood pressures. It can do all the things we need to do to reduce the stress levels in our patients. And that helps them feel better. It reduces pain. It reduces cardiac effects. And it has a lasting effect on how that patient responds to you and the next professional in the EMS environment that they come in contact with maybe a month, a week, a year, 2 years later. they will be more open to being treated by that person. So you do the next guy a service by treating the patient well. Michelle, I hope you take that as it's meant to be something that will encourage you to find a balance between professional distance and a caring approach to dealing with your patients. And I hope the rest of you understand that too. And thanks again for checking in over at Facebook, Michelle, and being a good friend over there. We've been in touch for a long time, and it's always great to hear from you. That's it. Don't forget to get in touch with me on the questions like this by sending those emails into podmedic@mac.com or checking in via Twitter or Facebook. And I love to hear from each and every one of you, and I will get back in touch with you real soon. Time now for this week's news, and we're going to start off with a story from Memphis. The Memphis Fire Department responds on EMS calls. I don't believe they participate in a lot of transport, but they do respond as first response units on EMS calls, and they're trying to find ways to save money on running these calls. You know, a lot of fire departments that run first responders, an engine company as a responders for an EMS-based call, non-rescue, non-fire, non-other typical structural-based responses, are going to maybe stop responding so much with the typical fire engine. I mean, think about it. It's a little bit of overkill to bring 500, 1,000 gallons of water, full pump, all the hose gear, ladders, and everything else that come along on a fire engine, and bring that to an EMS call when all you need are a heart monitor, some basic supplies, depending on whether you're an ALS or BLS unit. You basically can get away with what you can probably carry one or two people can carry along with them in a couple of bags. So I think a lot of agencies are going to be looking at alternate response vehicles, and they call these ARVs in this particular article, and they're talking about how these could save up to $17,000 per year on fuel and maintenance for each vehicle compared to the fire engines used typically for response. This is going to save a lot of money. I mean, if you think about it, less miles put on the fire engines means they last longer. They can stay in service longer. Alternate response vehicles, they don't say specifically what they're talking about, but we could be talking about small SUVs. We could be talking about just normal, ordinary sedans with lights and striping and everything else you need for an emergency vehicle. And you could respond, if you're not going to be doing transport, you could respond to handle patients with just a basic chase car. And so I think we're going to see more and more of this change in focus. I think one of the good things that's come out of the tightened budgets has been people really in agencies and cities, fire departments and third services all across the country and around the world, looking harder at not doing things the same old way they've always been done. In the past, there's a lot of tradition and a lot of, quite honestly, pigheadedness in how we do things in the EMS service and the fire service. And so it's very interesting to see how this particular company, and I think others are going to be considering providing medical services to their community on an emergency basis, even if they don't provide transport, and doing it with these other vehicles, these other response types. So you don't have to send four people on an engine either. You could just send two people. I mean, you can get twice the response out of a four-man engine company by sending them in a chase vehicle like this. We see fewer and fewer structural fires every year as building codes are continuing to improve. Sprinklers and smoke detectors and other things in residences continue to save lives. And so there is less and less need for structural firefighting on a regular basis at the level that it might have been needed 30 years ago. We see fire departments closing station houses, much to the consternation of community members, despite the fact that those station houses in their communities, in many cases, they don't even realize it, no longer house a fire engine. They only had an ambulance sitting in them. So it really is interesting to see how these things change. And I think this is going to continue. And I think it, again, is a good thing, is a positive change associated with the recent recession and budget tightening, because I think we need to think outside of the box, and being forced to do so means that you come up with other ideas and other plans that really would have made a lot of sense a long time ago and saved a significant amount of money for the agencies in question. So we'll see more of these, and I thought you might want to check it out. There's, again, a link in the show notes to all of these articles, and you should check these out for yourselves. And I'd love to hear back from you. What are your agencies doing? What are your services doing to change the way they respond? Some services might be moving back to a smaller van-style ambulance for transport, not using the big, the big diesel trucks and truck chassis that a lot of places use. You can, of course, fit less equipment in there, but it's much less expensive to operate. And in services where you have less transport times, you may not need to carry as much with you in the back of an ambulance. More nonsense coming to a head in the next story about the EMT fake certification scandal affecting firefighters in the northeast of the United States, in Haverhill, Massachusetts, and other areas in that region, where departments are finding that their firefighters were falsifying their certification records to say that they had maintained recertification for their EMTs at a minimum level of training and hours, when in fact they had not. And so there's some pretty stiff penalties coming down for these workers, and I think rightly so. But the fire union and the mayor trading issues over this in Haverhill. The president of the firefighters union is saying that they are mishandling this problem and that the taxpayers are going to have to pay extra overtime to cover for the fact that they are suspending 29 firefighters without pay. I think he's suspending the firefighters for a significant amount of time without pay. And I think they should be. I mean, let's face it, they are supposed to be EMTs. I know a lot of firefighters complain about the fact that if they're going to maintain their EMT, they have to maintain this continuing education, because you don't have to have continuing education required of you in your firefighting certifications. So they don't feel like they should have to do it for the medical side either. But that goes with the job. And we just talked in the last story about how that is increasingly the responsibility of fire departments to at least provide first responder emergency medical services to their community. And that requires their firefighters to be trained to provide at least a BLS level of care, an EMT level of care. So it is interesting to see that, you know, this union head, and it can, you know, first of all, it's his job to fight for the members of his union and argue against penalties that they might receive. But you know what? I think the mayor has the right of it. Yes, the city's probably going to pay more in overtime to cover for the suspensions handed out to these 29 firefighters who falsified their certifications. He points out that if this had been the private sector, they probably all would have been fired from a job where they had falsified documentation on their qualifications and certifications for work. And so only because they are in the public safety field and are needed by this community in the long term are they being only suspended without pay. And I think that he's right to say that they should feel lucky that that's all they're getting. And I have to agree with that. I think there's no place for this. And this scandal has reached far and wide and caused a lot of discussion here on this show as well as others. And I think that we're going to continue to see this kind of fallout when we see these kind of things. The fire departments are reshaping themselves and re-examining their primary mission. And more often, when you look at the call volume and the miles traveled and the man hours put towards it, many fire departments in metropolitan areas are actually spending more time being medical providers than firefighters. And so it is becoming more and more frequently a primary mission of the fire department. Our final news story of the day is going to be looking at recent changes in the U.S. dietary guidelines. Oh, wait a minute. What does this have to do with EMS? Well, it has to do with EMS in a couple of different ways. It has to do with us in EMS. We should be making sure we're trying to stay healthy and fit and exercise as necessary. But also, we need to be aware of what's proper for our patients and be advocates and provide opportunities for learning for our patients when we transport them. You know, we're not going to be doing long-term education on nutrition and things like that, but we can talk to the patient about diet on the route to the hospital and relay that information on to the nurses so they can put the patient in charge with dietitians and home health resources that can help them to maybe better care for themselves. This is all benefiting all of us in the long term as we continue to deal with increased call volume, as our aging population will continue to need us more and more frequently for chronic and treatable health problems, preventable health problems in many cases. Why don't we do more to start getting onto that prevention bandwagon now? And part of that is starting to be proponents and educators about diet and proper nutrition for the people we talk with. If we can help a patient become healthier, we help a patient stop calling the ambulance for service all the time. One of the things they're talking about is that they want to limit daily sodium intake to less than 2,300 milligrams a day for people. And that's because they're finding that salt has an immediate and negative effect on the heart because of its effects on water and fluid balance in the body. It affects blood pressure. And it really is looking at how this is affecting people very quickly. And people who have a high sodium diet have increased risk of hypertension. Untreated hypertension leads to stroke, other cardiovascular illnesses. Patients who have high salt intake often also have high fat intake. And this will lead to obesity, diabetes, chronic illness, cardiovascular failure, heart failure, and more. So it's important to understand what the guidelines are to help reflect and be able to point people to resources for those guidelines, and to be able to at least be the initial voice for helping patients change their lifestyles. And hopefully helping us to change our lifestyles as well. I mean, let's face it, we're not always the healthiest and best eaters ourselves. And we often chalk it up to the fact that our jobs are so hectic. But quite honestly, I don't know how frequently or how hard we try to eat healthily on the job either. We just use it as an excuse to eat fast food and eat on the go. And I'm just as guilty of that as everybody else is. So we should, we really need to focus a little bit more on how we can better serve our patients and ourselves by being aware and understanding the whole health picture for our patients. By being part of that prevention model, that better overall health model, we can cut down on the number of ambulance calls significantly over time, because a healthier population, a patient who is able to better manage their chronic illnesses because they have better nutritional control and better lifestyle, are going to have less need for an ambulance. And we're going to be able to cut back on our increased call volumes significantly at a time when we're expecting to be busier and busier. So I want you to check out this and other links in the show notes for this episode, and follow up on these things. And I look forward to hearing back from you. You can always send emails in to me, podmedic@mac.com. I look forward to hearing from each and every one of you. We're going to jump into this week's tip and trick of the week right now. And this is going to be part two of the segment we started last week on scene survey and the initial assessment phase of patient care. And I often combine these two together during educational sessions because I think that they overlap so much, it almost just makes more sense to teach them at the same time. So we're going to be talking about that. We kind of finished up with scene survey last week, and we'll jump into initial assessment. We're also going to talk about, at the end of this segment today, ways you can study and help you to learn the steps of scene survey and initial assessment for those of you that are students, and always a good review for you existing professionals out there. You know, it never hurts to review the basics. You can ask any athlete that. You can certainly, I think, ask other medical professionals that. There are going to be always those little details that you will say, you know, I forgot about that. And maybe you start to gloss over some of those details as you begin to grow your assessment skills, and you start forgetting the little things that helped you along the way. And maybe you need to revisit some of those. So we're going to cover that here in this segment, coming up part two of the segment we began last week on scene survey and initial assessment. Now we're into the initial assessment. We've kind of gotten a look at what's going on in the scene. Now we're going to move up and talk to her and start dealing with specifics about our patient. Now, remember I said these things overlap. If you remember, we were already looking at mechanism of injury, nature of the illness. We were looking at the number of patients. So we've already had patient contact. And there are steps of this initial assessment you can do while you're walking across the room to the patient. You can get a sense of their color, of their work of breathing. So, and this is where, you know, you get that older, more experienced paramedic that's been on that number of calls where they can walk into a room and tell if that patient is serious or not just by looking at them. Now, does this mean that they blow off the rest of the assessment? No, because they can be being deceived by something else going on. You know, if you have a patient that maybe has had some carbon monoxide and poisoning, they may have a rosier color than their bleeding out might indicate, right? So we might be deceived by other things going on. But there is certainly a way that you can kind of walk into a room, and sometimes that really sick patient, you can tell right away they're really sick. It's the well patient, you still need to maintain that index of suspicion to make sure that your initial impression as you walk up to them is correct. So that's where you gather that general impression. You're walking up to them. You want to get a sense of their mental status, okay? And this is where you have that AVPU. Are they awake and alert to their surroundings? Do they become alert when you speak to them? Are they alert to painful response, or are they unresponsive? Also, some people will start doing a GCS at this stage, depending on whether the patient is conversing or not. You know, if you can kind of get a sense of GCS as you look back at this stage of the game. You may not be writing that GCS number down here, but later, as you're looking at your charts, you can say, oh, when I did that mental status check, their GCS was 12. You know, and you can go down the three stages and look at that. Next, ABCs. So general impression, mental status, and now we're dealing with the basics: airway, breathing, and circulation, and any specific life threats that are happening here. This is where you are looking for, is the patient breathing? Is their airway open? Is their airway compromised? Do we have signs of severe bleeding that needs to be controlled immediately? Okay. And you don't go any farther along this process until you've dealt with these life threats, okay? This is that stage where you stop. So if you're doing the scene size up and you're walking up and your mechanism of injury and checking patients and you're thinking about additional resources and are you going to call for them or not, and you see somebody with spurting arterial blood, you're not going to call for additional resources right away. You're not going to go any further in any other steps of that process until you've stopped that bleeding. Okay, so this is where you kind of have to think about that interlacing of the scene survey and the initial assessment. So once you've controlled those life threats, you're going to be dealing with airway. You may be moving right to opening the airway and then looking to see if it's a crushed airway and you have to do a needle crike or a cricothyrotomy. You're looking at bleeding. You may have to do needle decompression for a pneumothorax. This is where you deal with those life threats, and this is where those specific interventions come in. Prioritize your transport and your destinations. And so you're thinking about, all right, how sick is this patient? Is this a load and go? Is this a stay and play? We've all heard that, right? There may be things that change that based on the scene survey. But certainly prioritizing your transport is very important. And during a testing situation, you will be expected to say, this is a critical patient. It's a priority one, priority two, priority three patient. And we are going to take this patient to the cath lab, the stroke center, the trauma center, the local hospital. Okay, so this is where you'll prioritize that. I've talked a little bit about studying this and along the way because I've given you a sense of it. Certainly, listening or watching something like this is a way to study for this type of thing. But there are different learning styles, so let's talk a little bit about that. You can be a hands-on learner. You can be one of those people that needs to be playing with something, to hold something in your hands, to see how it works, to practice putting it on and taking it off. Hands-on assessment and hands-on learning, and that's important. So there are certain things you can do if you're a hands-on learner to supplement the book learning that goes along with that. Practice your skills, okay? There's no substitute for getting in there and doing the skills. When we practice something over and over again, not just once or twice, but 10, 20, 30 times, when we practice something over and over and over again, we develop muscle memory. Our body learns to just do it. And think about it. When you drive to school or drive to work, there are times where you can't remember what you did for a couple of miles because you were thinking about something else. Did the car veer off the road? No. your body knows how to drive and your eyes know how to keep you between the lines and look for oncoming traffic while you're driving. You don't have to consciously think about putting your foot on the brake and slowing down or the gas pedal or steering. It happens. It's natural. Same thing happens when you practice your skills, and that includes your assessment skills. You need to get in there and run through some things. So create scenarios. When you have a group of people and you got a study group, and I urge you to form study groups, maybe four or five people and at tops, really. But you create study groups and you tell everybody, all right, we're going to be studying in scene survey, initial assessment. Everybody, the next time we get together is going to be 3 days from now. Everybody needs to write four scenarios for us to review. And we're all going to practice them. We'll take turns being in charge. We'll put them in a hat and we'll draw the scenarios out. Okay? That's how you do it. Everybody comes up with something different. Everybody has their different little quirks in there. Some of them are going to be similar, sure, but they're going to be some different situations. You're going to have new environments and new locations to try. And what do I mean by new environments and new locations? There's nothing like trying to do some of these skills while you simulate being in the back of a cramped, compact car. Okay? It's a whole different thing trying to do a quick initial assessment on a patient when you can't fit comfortably sitting next to them in a cramped location. So, you know, stack a bunch of chairs together. You know how the chairs in your classroom stack up? Well, take a couple of stacks and create a little small space. Put a chair in the middle of that and another chair next to it, and then make one of you crawl in there and try to perform some kind of functional assessment. It makes you think a little bit more. It makes you try things in a different way. And it's going to make you better at this because you're going to have to apply your knowledge in a different way. And by doing that, you create other connections in your brain between your motor skills and your psychological thought process. So that psychomotor connection is very important for hands-on learners. And try to learn these skills in as many different ways as you can, because those different connections end up paying off for you. Some of you are memorizers. Some of you can read something once and you remember it, or at least the basics of it, for a long time. Memorizers or people that are book learners have different needs. Obviously, everyone's kind of a combination of these processes. Some are better at some things than others. So you're going to need to use all of these skills. But if you're better at book learning, then obviously you're going to be focusing more on this type of memorization. Flashcards are the number one way I learned my drugs, the number one way I learned the different steps of my assessments. I kept flashcards with me everywhere I went. For EMT, for a paramedic, I made them. I just got a pack of note cards and I made flashcards for everything. Got me through nursing school, where I had all the additional medications and pharmacology that went along with that. Really, and there was just so much to keep track of, flashcards came in handy. So that's important. Also, writing out the steps, just sitting down and writing out what you need to do is very important way to memorize, because by having to spit that information back out again, you're making your memory work in a different way by putting it out. So there's both input and output memorization tools. Teach others. You know, if you can take the knowledge and apply it and teach others what the steps are. And so this is where your study group comes in, where you teach the study group the things you've learned about this process. That teaching others is another way to reinforce that memory. And so that's important. Finally, visualization. You know, we talk about athletes doing this kind of thing all the time. And visualization is one of those underutilized aspects of learning. We can talk to your Olympic athletes and talk to your professional athletes, and they'll tell you that after practice, they visualize themselves doing the things that they practiced in their mind's eye. They see their brain in their brain doing it again and again. They visualize the race. They visualize the game and running a certain play a certain way in football, or getting over and getting to that ball that's hit past you in a baseball game, and you've got to stretch that little bit more, visualizing that you get to it and that you come up and you throw accurately. Why is that important? Well, it's an interesting thing about the brain, and I've had this explained to me a couple different ways, but I'll tell you the way I think about it. Your brain is smart, but it's stupid. The brain doesn't have any way of knowing what the heck's going on outside of the skull other than what you tell it, okay? So if your eyes are closed, it has to assume that what you're thinking about is what's going on around you, okay? So if you can close your eyes and visualize yourself arriving at the scene, doing the steps of the scene survey, going through the steps of the patient assessment, visualizing you performing those life-saving skills for those life-threatening injuries, your brain assumes it's really happening because it can't tell the difference between what is going on outside and what you're imagining. So by visualizing, you actually create the perfect combination of hands-on knowledge and memorization by bringing those psychomotor skills together and creating and cementing that muscle memory with yet another connection in your brain, you visualizing success. And there's numerous studies about how this works with athletes. There's absolutely no reason that can't work with any physical skill. So it works with shooting foul shots in basketball. It can work with intubating a patient or doing a needle decompression or anything else that you have to do a series of steps to perform it successfully. So think about visualization as another way. And that can be done while you're driving down the road. Okay, there's lots of different things you can do to put this memory in there. And so studying assessment or studying anything really is a way of utilizing these three things. There are a lot of resources on this that I've pulled in. There's just a ton of stuff out there. Your own instructors have probably given you many things. There's a great article about scene size up over at emsworld.com by Dan Limmer and others, called Beyond the Basics, Scene Size Up, from 2008, I think it was. But just a great article, and Dan's a good educator and has some good information to impart there. And it's just a different view of scene size up. I've got a link in the show notes to some other links and information you might want to check out about initial assessment and scene size up, and you can find all of that over in the page for this particular segment and episode. And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank everybody for checking out this week's episode and remind you that there are links to all the news items and all of the additional links and resources that are provided for this week's Tip of the Week and, of course, every week's segments of tips and interviews, all available for you over at the MedicCast site at mediccast.com/blog. You can also check out the links for show notes right at the top of the page, and that'll take you to that page. There's also links there to sign up for the newsletter, get the email newsletter sent to you each week, and you'll have those links in your email box each week, plus occasionally a couple of other emails throughout the course of the month to just share with you what's going on at the site or information you might be interested in that we're hoping to share with you. Of course, we keep that private, and we never share your email address with anybody else. You can also in on the voicemail line, 941-306-3342, or send an email in to podmedic@mac.com. I look forward to hearing from each and every one of you, and it is always a great joy to hear from you, whether you're a student, an existing provider. How are you using the MedicCast to improve what you do? What do you like about the show recently? What don't you like? Do you have some things you'd like to share? Perhaps an idea for a future tip of the week, or perhaps you'd like to share a link for a news item. Just send those things in to me. Don't assume that I found every little news item about EMS out there. Send me a link and let me know in a brief paragraph why you think that link is an important link to share. And even if I don't necessarily share it on the show, I may write an article about it and I will respond back to you and let you know that I got it. And it's always great to hear from you. Don't forget to also become a fan of the show over on Facebook. Facebook.com/MedicCast, and you can click the like button right there at the top of the page. You know, there are thousands, a couple thousand listeners that are now fans or viewers, I guess. We also have our video programs now. Viewers or fans over there, and I would urge you to check that out and become a fan here of the MedicCast over on Facebook. There will also be a lot of information being posted over the at the end of this month and the beginning of March as we head down to EMS Today. We're going to be joining the ProMed Network booth down there, and we want to thank EMS Today and GEMS for inviting us to come down, and we'll be covering the conference live with a bunch of shows in the EMS sector from various podcasters on the ProMed Network talking about what's going on at the show, doing our regular shows and recording there live. If you're going to be coming to Baltimore the first week of March, I think it's March 1st through the 5th, you should come on down and get to the exhibit hall. We'll be broadcasting live the entire time. Whenever the exhibit hall's open, we'll have shows either on or getting ready to start, and we'd love you to come in. There's going to be chairs there. Don't feel embarrassed. Just come in and sit down and join the show, and then, you know, sit around afterwards and chat with your favorite podcasters and pick up some stuff that we'll have there for you to take home. Share the Medicast with people you know, and just come up and meet us. We all love to meet you, and if you see me there, please stop me and say hello. I just want to meet as many of you as possible when you come to Baltimore, so we'll see you there coming up soon. And again, thanks to EMS Today and GEMS. You can find out more at emstoday.com on how to get there. There's a ton of great educational resources, and of course, the exhibit hall with all of the new things and equipment and toys you can lay your hands on to just try and see what's new out there in the EMS sector. And we'll be there covering that live from the show floor. That's it. I'm going to close out today's show with a brief song, actually a brief song, a song by Johanna Staley. We've played her music here before. It's called I'm Not Perfect. I think it's one of my theme songs. I'm not perfect. I try to give you the best information, but sometimes I make errors, as we all do. But Johanna's got some great music. Follow the link in her show notes, and if you like what you hear, you can click on the link there and check out her songs directly in iTunes and maybe purchase one while you're over there. Or you can just go to her website and let her know you heard her song here on the Medicast. That's it. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. I'll be back again next week with another episode of the Medicast. And in the meantime, please remember to stay safe and remember Scene Safety, BSI.
Hi, this is Johanna Staley, and you're about to listen to some music from my CD, I'm Not Perfect. I want to thank you guys for making such a difference. Keep up the good work.